It's so good to be together. I'm really grateful for everybody who's here this morning. As I said on Friday, I've never been here before coming for this series, but I feel like I know so many of you already from different get-togethers in the Northeast area, and it's just so good to be with you. And I'm grateful for the work that the Lord is doing in this place through His servants here, and I pray that you will continue to keep that up. It's been so good to be in God's Word this weekend, and we're going to be looking at the example of Moses. Actually, turn your Bibles to Acts chapter 7. We're going to be beginning there in just a minute as we look at Stephen's comments on Moses. But the thing that we're going to try to look at this morning with Moses, I mean, we could do lessons on Moses for like a month or more. There's a lot to be said about Moses. We know a lot about him. We're going to try to look in particular at a couple of aspects of Moses in our lesson today, particularly one to see how the Lord molded Moses to be a man who was humble, who was meek. And Numbers says he was the meekest man who ever lived. And the other dimension of Moses is think a little bit about his leadership and his humility in that. And we're going to look at particularly a couple of events in the life of Moses and think about some applications for ourselves. So in Acts chapter 7, we're going to think about just the process by which the Lord broke down and rebuilt Moses. Of course, Moses was born in a time of a lot of turbulence. The young Hebrew boys were being slaughtered at the command of Pharaoh, and Moses was spared. He was blessed to be born into a family that feared the Lord and did not fear the king, as we just read in Hebrews chapter 11, that his parents kept him alive. And Moses was then, after 3 months, put into a basket in the river and drifted down, you know, and it's kind of at the mercy of the Lord and His providence. And of all places, he ends up in Pharaoh's household. Pharaoh's daughter finds him. And you think it would be the last place that Moses would find mercy? And yet the Lord blesses Moses with the compassion of Pharaoh's daughter. And he is adopted, essentially, into Pharaoh's family, is raised with the teaching and the education of the Egyptians, which, of course, at that time in world history, you couldn't have a better education, a more technologically advanced society for the time. And so Moses is just given this incredible position, and somewhere along the line, Moses is aware of his Hebrew heritage. And so he makes a faithful decision. Acts chapter 7, we're going to begin reading in Acts in verse 23. Acts 7, verse 23. And again, Stephen is speaking here to the Jewish leaders, but he talks about Moses here. And he says, so Acts 7, 23. But when he, Moses, was approaching the age of 40, it entered his mind to visit his brethren, the sons of Israel. And when he saw one of them being treated unjustly, he defended him and took vengeance for the oppressed by striking down the Egyptian. And he supposed that his brethren understood that God was granting them deliverance through him. But they did not understand. On the following day, he appeared to them as they were fighting together, and he tried to reconcile them in peace, saying, "Men, you are brethren. Why do you injure one another?" But the one who was injuring his neighbor pushed him away, saying, "Who made you a ruler and a judge over us? You do not mean to kill me as you killed the Egyptian yesterday, do you?" At this remark, Moses fled and became an alien in the land of Midian, where he became the father of two sons. And the beginning of the next verse, after 40 years had passed, he spends 40 years there in Midian. When we think about Moses' formation as a leader, he begins with kind of a bang. And he decides, okay, I'm going to forsake, you know, all that I could have had as a child of Pharaoh, son of Pharaoh's daughter, and then be able to go and be with my people. Hebrews 11 talks about that he you know, forsook the riches of Egypt, considered the reproach of Christ greater than that. And so he goes to his people, and he thinks, this is my moment, I'm going to lead, I'm going to deliver my people, and they're going to see that, and they're going to understand that, and this is going to be great. And so he sees, you know, his brother being mistreated, and he rises up and he kills the Egyptian, and then he tries to reconcile his brothers, he sees them fighting as well, and he's like, "Hey guys, what do you think you're doing?" And so they like accept Moses, and everything's great, right? Now, things kind of blow up in Moses' face. Is he was in a position of power, a position of influence, and he was trying to associate with God's people. But when Moses first tries to step out and lead, he's rejected. He is told, "Who made you a ruler and a judge over us?" And they push him away, and Moses ends up in that moment, in part because of the wrath of the king, but also in part because it was a failed attempt to lead and to try to rescue his people. And you imagine, you put yourself in Moses' shoes for a minute, where you've just been kind of given everything in your life, and you're in this great position, you think, to lead, and then even the slaves that you're trying to save, like, it just blows up in your face. And so Moses, I think, perhaps the pride and the self-sufficiency that he had kind of going in is going to be broken down with 40 years of training, and we might call this humility training, in the wilderness. And what is he doing for those 40 years? He's a shepherd. He's working with sheep. These unruly, kind of not renowned for their intelligence, animals. And Moses is a nobody in a strange land. And the Lord is, I think, shaping and working with Moses in during these years. And you think about really what God does with a lot of leaders is he takes them through a time of difficulty, a time of just being nobody before they kind of step out and are able to lead. It's interesting that who is Moses' assistant going to be later on? It's going to be Joshua. Do you remember Joshua's kind of first step into the public light? It was when he was selected as one of the 12 spies, right? And he and Caleb, among the other 10, go into the land of Canaan, and the 10 bring back a terrible report that these guys are huge, the walls are, these cities are crazy, we can't do it. But Joshua and Caleb are like, no, like, we can do it, we're going to lead the people. And what happened? People listened to the 10. Joshua kind of also began with a kind of a failed attempt to change the hearts of God's people. And then Joshua spent the next 40 years doing what? Kind of training under Moses in the wilderness. So it's just kind of interesting to see the way that the Lord is shaping Moses and then the way that the Lord is going to shape Joshua later on as well. But one of the things I want us to see here is that for God to really use us, we can't be prideful. We can't take things into our own hands and think that we're the one who's going to save the day. Because when we do that, hopefully the Lord kind of allows it to blow up in our face and humbles us to where we have to trust in Him. The next thing that's really going to happen in Moses' life, if you open up to Exodus chapter 3, is God is going to show up to this nobody shepherd in the middle of nowhere and tell him, okay, it's been another 40 years. Or it's been 40 years at this point. Moses was 40 when he fled. And now is the time. Now you're going to lead my people. Now you're going to go and deliver them. Kind of like you wanted to do back when you killed the Egyptian. And of course, we're going to see Moses just kind of backpedaling at this point. And he doesn't think he's anybody. And we won't read this whole text this morning, but God shows up to Moses. It's notable that he reveals himself. He is described as the consuming fire at different places. And he reveals himself in this burning bush that's burning, but it's not consumed, which is really kind of amazing that as we approach God, we're not consumed. And so the Lord calls out to him from the midst of the bush, verse 4, "Moses, Moses." And he said, "Here I am." Then he said, "Do not come near here. Remove your sandals from your feet, for the place on which you're standing is holy ground." He said also, "I am the God of your father, the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, and the God of Jacob." Then Moses hid his face, for he was afraid to look at God. Note that for a little bit later. We'll kind of come back to that. The Lord said, verse 7, "I have surely seen the affliction of my people who are in Egypt and have given heed to their cry because of their taskmasters, for I am aware of their sufferings." Which we need to remember that. "So I have come down to deliver them from the power of the Egyptians and to bring them up from the land to a good and spacious land, to a land flowing with milk and honey, to the place of the Canaanite and the Hittite and the Amorite and the Perizzite, the Hivite, the Jebusite. Now behold, the cry of the sons of Israel has come to me. Furthermore, I have seen the oppression with which the Egyptians are oppressing them. Therefore come now and I will send you to Pharaoh so that you may bring my people, the sons of Israel, out of Egypt." This is the opportunity Moses has been waiting for, right? And what's the next thing that's going to come out of Moses' mouth? He's just going to start listing excuse after excuse after excuse. And we're going to see five excuses of Moses that we're just going to go through very briefly. And we're going to see that for each excuse that Moses brings up, God has an answer for him. And we might think about kind of some of the excuses that we might bring up. There are times where we need to be humbled by God. And then there's times where we need to step up and serve where we might be afraid to serve. The first thing that Moses says in verse 11, but Moses said to God, "Who am I that I should go to Pharaoh and that I should bring the sons of Israel out of Egypt?" So Moses' essential first question is, why me? Of all the people, you know, why me? And God comes back, verse 12, and he says, and he said, "Certainly I will be with you, and this shall be the sign to you that it is I who have sent you. When you have brought the people out of Egypt, you shall worship God at this mountain." Which, by the way, I didn't realize this for a long time, but the burning bush is at Mount Horeb, Mount Sinai. It's where Moses is going to encounter God again later on. And so essentially, when Moses asks the question, "Who am I?" God just says, "It doesn't really matter, because I'm with you." It doesn't matter who you are, or where you come from, or what your background is, or your ability level. If God's with us, who can be against us? In verse 13, Moses is not satisfied with that. And so Moses said to God, "Behold, I'm going to the sons of Israel, and I will say to them, 'The God of your fathers has sent me to you.' Now they may say to me, 'What is his name?' So what shall I say to them?" So it's kind of interesting that Moses is first worried about, "Who am I?" And then God answers, "It doesn't matter, I'm with you." And the second, "Well, who are you?" is essentially what Moses is saying. And of course, this is where the Lord first reveals his personal name to them. In verses... Oh, wow, that wasn't the button I meant to press. Well, get this running again. Oh, well. Okay. It's not a good sermon unless there's some technological difficulties, right? Alright, verses 14, and we won't read this whole section, but God said to Moses, "I am who I am." And he said, "Thus you shall say to the sons of Israel, I am has sent me to you." And he goes on to describe, "I'm the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob." So much we could say about God's name here and what all this means. But essentially, he says, I'm the one. I'm the self-existent one from everlasting to everlasting. Not I was, not I will be. I am. And I always am. And so God reveals to him, this is the way you're going to introduce God. From this phrase, "I am," we get the derivative words Jehovah or Yahweh. It's kind of tied in with the Hebrew word that's used for God. And so the "I am" is with Moses as he goes. And we skip down to chapter 4, verse 1. Still, Moses is not satisfied. And then Moses said, "Well, what if they will not believe me or listen to what I say? For they may say, 'The Lord has not appeared to you.'" The Lord said to him, "What is that in your hand?" So Moses, I think from his previous experience with the children of Israel, is like, "Well, they didn't listen to me the first time. Why should they listen to me the second time?" And I love what the Lord says to him here. As Moses is worried about what he doesn't have. "Oh, they're not going to listen to me. They're not going to believe me," or whatever. And God says, "What's that in your hand?" And he's going to use that staff to perform these signs to convince the children of Israel that, yes, God really is with me. I can't do these things unless God is with me. But you know, isn't that the way we are so many times? As we've been given a mission, we've got an opportunity, and we've got all these excuses. Who am I? I mean, what about God and his identity? And what about the people I'm going to? You know, they're not going to listen to me. And I just don't have what it takes to really do this work that God wants me to do. And God, so to speak, can look at us and say, "Well, what's that in your hand? What do you have? We'll use that." It's a little bit like when Jesus said to his disciples, when they had thousands of people there who were gathered to hear Jesus, and he said, "Man, it's getting late and these people are hungry. You give them something to eat." And what did the disciples say? "Man, if we had like 200 denarii, like there's no way. It's not like there's restaurants out here in the wilderness. We can't give these people anything to eat. We can't." And Jesus says, "What do you have? Go and see." And I said, "Man, we got 5 loaves and 2 fish. But what is that for so many?" And God uses the meager things that they have to be sufficient for the work that's given. And here Moses, all he's got his shepherd's staff, right? He's been doing that for 40 years. Okay, we'll use that. And that staff, you think about kind of what that staff is going to go on to do. It's held up over the Red Sea and the sea parts and it becomes a snake. You know, all these different things. God can use what we have if we are willing to give it all to Him. And that's, I think, one of the great things we learn about Moses here. In chapter 4, verse 10, Moses is still not convinced to go do the work. Then Moses said to the Lord, "Please, Lord, I have never been eloquent, neither recently nor in time past, nor since you have spoken to your servant, for I am slow of speech and slow of tongue." So Moses is still saying, "I don't have what it takes. I don't have the skill. If I want to be talking to Pharaoh, like the most powerful guy in the world right now, I don't know how to talk. I'm slow of speech, slow of tongue." And man, I mean, isn't that the way we feel so many times? And the Lord comes back, verse 11 and 12, where He says, "The Lord said to him, 'Who has made man's mouth? Or who makes him mute or deaf or seeing or blind? Is it not I, the Lord? Now then go, and I, even I, will be with your mouth and teach you what you are to say.'" And again, the Lord just makes the point. Listen, whatever abilities you have or don't have is from me. I have equipped you with everything, and I will teach you what you're going to say. And we need to remember that too. Is whatever skill level, whatever ability level we might be at, God can help us to be what we need to be to do His work. You just see how God is like taking every excuse away from Moses here. And so I think Moses is just kind of desperate at this point. God is kind of shot down everything he's been saying. And verse 13, but he said, "Please, Lord, now send the message by whomever you will." In other words, not me, just anybody but me. Send somebody else. And at this point, the Lord is not happy with Moses. Kind of understandably so. Verse 14, "And the anger of the Lord burned against Moses, and he said, 'Is there not your brother Aaron the Levite? I know that he speaks fluently. And moreover, behold, he is coming out to meet you. When he sees you, he'll be glad in his heart.'" And he essentially says, he's going to be your spokesperson. And so, again, when we're scared to go, God doesn't let Moses off the hook and send Aaron instead, but he says, "Here's a brother. Here's someone to go with you, and so that you can do my work." And aren't we blessed to have brethren that can help us in the work? So again, there's so many lessons we could talk more about, but I hope we just see this picture of Moses. You know, he's gone from being the prideful guy taking matters into his own hands, and now he's been humbled in the wilderness, and he needs encouragement and God to kind of take away his excuses so that he can be bold enough to go do this. And what's interesting about this is when Moses first starts out, things just go great, right? He comes back to the children of Israel. He says, "Let my people go." And Pharaoh's like, "Oh, that's cool. Good to see you again, by the way." And, you know, that's not the way this goes. Exodus chapter 5, even when he comes back to the children of Israel, and the first time he goes to Pharaoh, things just get harder. Then he gives him more work to do. And he's like, "Man, this is the opposite. I've come back and done what you wanted me to do, Lord. And now it's harder on them. But they're not saved. What is going on?" So the end of Exodus 5, verse 22, "Then Moses returned to the Lord and said, 'O Lord, why have you brought harm to this people? Why did you ever send me? Ever since I came to Pharaoh to speak in your name, he has done harm to this people, and you have not delivered your people at all.'" And the Lord's basically going to say, "You just wait and see. I'm going to take care of Pharaoh." You know, I think sometimes, though, we feel like Moses in this moment, don't we? As we start to kind of reach out and we're met with rejection, things might even get worse for a little while. And we have to learn to trust God. That even as we're doing the things that He's telling us to do, and maybe things aren't going well, we need to learn, like Moses, to be patient, to be humble, to trust in the Lord. And he does come to God. He says, "Lord, I don't get it. What's going on?" When you look at the Psalms, isn't that like what so much of the Psalms are? It's like, "Lord, I'm doing what's right. What gives? Like, this is hard." And that's the picture of us trying to work with God and learn to trust in Him, even when things are backfiring. But God uses Moses. And by the time we get to Exodus chapter 7, it's Moses and Aaron, "Let my people go. Let my people go. Let my people go." And of course, the Lord is the one reaching out, as He says, like with a mighty hand and an outstretched arm. God's basically like flexing His muscle to the Egyptians, saying, "I am God, and your gods? You think they control the weather, and they control the animals, and they control the Nile? Let me show you what I think about your gods." And He just, you know, so many of the plagues are in direct defiance of the so-called Egyptian gods that they were serving. And so that's exactly what happens, is the Lord uses Moses to lead the people out of the land of Israel. And so we're going to flip over, and again, we're skipping over a lot here, to Exodus chapter 19. So when they come back to Mount Sinai, and they've come out of the land of Egypt, the plagues have happened, they've gone through the Red Sea, and of course, things went really well with Moses, with the children of Israel when they got to the Red Sea, right? The children of Israel were so grateful. Oh, thank you for bringing us out here. Hey, by the way, how are we going to cross the sea? You know, they were complaining against Moses from like day one of the time that they left. They're like, were there not graves in Egypt? Let's go back there. You know, and then God parts the sea. They go out here and they're like, where's the food? You know, and again, at every step, the people of God are just hard on Moses. And he bears up under that during this time. So they come to Mount Sinai. One of the things I think is really cool about this section of Exodus, really from here to the end of the book of Exodus, is it's all about Moses and his interactions with the people of God and with God at Mount Sinai. Remember when I was young, I always thought of it as being kind of like this one-trip thing where like, okay, they come to Mount Sinai and like Moses goes up, gets the Ten Commandments, some other laws too, comes back down, you know, and he's got the tablets, oh, and he breaks them, and then he has to go get some other ones, and that's kind of what happens at Mount Sinai. There are, if I'm counting correctly, 8 trips up Mount Sinai that Moses makes in this section. And we're going to kind of just briefly look at these different trips and see the role of Moses and his leadership in this time of serving God's people. So, trip number one, Exodus chapter 19, verses 3 through 6. It says, Moses went up to God, and the Lord called to him from the mountain, saying, thus you shall say to the house of Jacob, and tell the sons of Israel, you yourselves have seen what I did to the Egyptians, and how I bore you on eagle's wings, and brought you to myself. Now then, if you will indeed obey my voice, and keep my covenant, then you shall be my own possession among all the peoples. For all the earth is mine, and you shall be to me a kingdom of priests and a holy nation. These are the words that you shall speak to the sons of Israel. So Moses came and called the elders of the people and set before them all the words which the Lord had commanded him. So trip number one is essentially Moses goes up and it's not like the Ten Commandments and stuff yet. He just says, this is the covenant that I want to make with you. Moses, this is what I want you to help me accomplish with this ragtag bunch of former slaves who have come out into the middle of nowhere, and I'm going to take them and make my own people to be called by my name in the midst of the earth. Of all the peoples, he didn't call the Egyptians. He didn't call the Philistines or some of the people that would have been more strong and mighty or smart or whatever. He takes the former slaves and says, these are mine. We're going to do something here. And note that what God wants is he wants us to be his. He wants us to belong to him. And so essentially, you have this like the two classic parts of any covenant. Which, by the way, a covenant is that idea of an agreement that defines a relationship, isn't it? What's the most common covenant that people make today? It's marriage, right? And it's two people saying, you and you alone, till death do us part. They make that agreement, it defines that relationship for the rest of their lives. And so the picture here is God is making this covenant with his people, and he says, look what I've done for you, and I will continue to take care of you. But what's the one thing that he asks? He says, if you will obey my voice and keep my covenant, just listen to me and do what I say. Trust and obey. And you'll be mine and I'll be yours forever. That's the picture that he gives. So he comes back down and in verse 8, all the people answered together and said, all that the Lord has spoken, we will do. So he comes back down and the people are like, okay, sounds good, God. We'd love to have your protection. Thank you for bringing us out of Egypt. We'll obey what the Lord says. And I can't help but wonder if Moses was already a little skeptical at this point as far as them falling through on that. But that's what the people say. They pledge their obedience to God. And so in verses 8 through 14, we're just going to summarize some of these things as we go. Moses goes up and he returns the people's answer and says, this is what the people have said. And then the Lord basically says, get ready, because in 3 days, on the third day, I'm going to come down and speak to the people.
And they need to wash themselves, they need to consecrate themselves, get ready, because I can't just come down and then be all unclean. They need to understand that I am holy. And so, the people get ready for the third day. The people gather together, the Lord descends, and it's at this point that Mount Sinai becomes that storm that like we always think about when you come to Mount Sinai. It's like the lightning and the earthquake and the thunder and the trumpet sound. This is when the Lord comes down. We're about to get ready for trip number three. And so the Lord comes down, the people have gathered together, and God calls to Moses from the storm and says, I want you to come up again one more time. I have one final warning for the people. And he kind of reinforces you better make a boundary so that the people don't even touch the mountain. You can't even get close. Which, by the way, though, Moses was called up right into the storm, right? Like, walk into it. Which, by the way, yesterday we were like driving up, and there was that squall line that came through. That's a scary thing to be like driving right into a storm. I can't imagine walking into one like as you're going up a mountain. So Moses is given kind of the final warning about the mountain. And then what's interesting to me is I always picture that God's speaking to Moses when he gives the Ten Commandments. But actually it appears like the end of chapter 19, that Moses comes down to the people, tells them, hey, stay away, don't touch the mountain. And then God himself, from the storm, speaks the Ten Commandments to the people. And his own voice, it's not Moses saying, hey, this is what God said. It's God himself saying, you will have no other gods before me. And so, of course, the Lord speaks the Ten Commandments. And what's the people's reaction at the end of that? Moses, please, you go back up on the mountain. We can't hear God and live. This is crazy. So terrifying is the voice of the Lord. And of course, Moses is saying, don't be afraid, verse 20, for God has come in order to test you, in order that the fear of Him may remain with you, so that you may not sin. One of the things God is using Moses to do is to get the fear of the Lord into the people. And that's one of the goals that we have in leadership, isn't it? Is to help people to know. Listen, you can't just play games with God. God is not your servant. God doesn't obey you. And you meet people who say things like, you know, oh, I just couldn't believe in a God who would. And you see what people do? Sometimes what we do when we think and talk like that? God's not our slave, not our servant. You're creating a God in your image when you do that. You're not coming to the God who is the creator of heaven and earth. And so Moses is, God through Moses here, is helping to introduce the people to God who really, I think for a long time, haven't known him. And they're like, okay, like, whew, we get it. Moses, you go talk to God and we'll listen to you instead. And so, trip number four is where we kind of get more what we think of in this. And this lasts like four chapters. So chapter 20, 21 through 24, 3. Moses does go up for the people, and he essentially gives them various laws. Again, this is just spelling out really the covenant that God promised back on trip number one, and saying, if you'll listen to me, keep my covenant. And now he's saying, this is what it looks like. And what does God's covenant look like? When you just like flip through the laws and stuff, a lot of it has to do with loving the Lord your God with all your heart and loving your neighbor as yourself. And God has to go into a lot of detail to spell that out for them. He's like, okay, you're not going to treat each other wrong. You're not going to exact interest from each other. A lot of the laws have to do with how they treat one another. And like J.D. was talking about, isn't that the struggle we have a lot of times? Our covenant with God is not just about Him. It's about how we treat each other. And that's what God is doing here. He's saying, I'll protect you. I'll take care of you. But you got to treat each other right. And you've got to serve me with all your heart. And so again, Moses comes down from time number four in chapter 24. The people say again, all that the Lord has spoken, we're going to do. And flip over there to chapter 24. I think this is really interesting. So they answer with this. They say, all the words which the Lord has spoken, we will do. Then verse 4, Moses wrote down all the words of the Lord. Then he rose early in the morning and built an altar at the foot of the mountain with 12 pillars for the 12 tribes of Israel. He sent young men of the sons of Israel, and they offered burnt offerings and sacrificed young bulls as peace offerings to the Lord. Moses took half of the blood and put it in basins, and the other half of the blood he sprinkled on the altar. Then he took the book of the covenant, which he had just written, and read it in the hearing of the people. And they said, all that the Lord has spoken we will do, and we will be obedient. So Moses took the blood and sprinkled it on the people and said, behold the blood of the covenant which the Lord has made with you in accordance with all these words. And this is just really cool that God is inaugurating this first covenant with blood, which we were reading from Hebrews this morning before partaking of the bread. And isn't it interesting that on the night that Jesus is betrayed, he says, take this bread, this is my body. And then he says, take this cup, what is it? It is the new covenant in my blood. And so this is kind of the first covenant being inaugurated, and it's the blood of bulls and goats and these things. Saying it sprinkles the book, sprinkles the people. This blood is like what can symbolizes you being made right with God, basically. And for us, it's every first day of the week. We get to together to remember the blood that allows us to be right with God. So I think there's really cool parallels here. And that's not all, but on trip number five kind of happens in three stages. And stage one, they go up on the mountain, and it's not just Moses this time. He takes Joshua, and he takes the 70 of the elders of Israel. And in verse 9, it says, then Moses went up with Aaron, Nadab and Abihu, and 70 of the elders of Israel. And they saw the God of Israel, and under his feet there appeared to be a pavement of sapphire, as clear as the sky itself. Yet he did not stretch out his hand against the nobles of the sons of Israel. And they saw God, and they ate and drank. I have a lot of questions about this section. But they see some glimpse of the glory of God. I think Moses is going to see maybe even a little more of a little bit later. But what do? When that group goes up on the mountain, they eat and drink. It's like a covenant meal. That was one of the things, especially in like the ancient Near East, that people would do. It's what Abraham and Melchizedek do when they kind of make their covenant, is they eat and drink. And so again, you've just had the blood of the covenant, and now they're sealing that covenant with a covenant meal between God and then Moses and the elders of Israel. And what are we doing every first day of the week? So we're like renewing that covenant. It's the covenant meal between us and God. Again, just so many foreshadowings here. And so step two is Moses and Joshua. God says, you come up close to the top of the mountain, and it's like 7 days before Moses goes all the way up. And then it's Moses alone who goes into the cloud to meet with the Lord, starting in 24. And this is going to take us way into chapter 32 of Exodus. And this is finally when Moses spends 40 days on the mountain, by the way. It's trip number five. So continuing trip number five, this is the trip. Well, while Moses is up on the mountain for the fifth time, what's going on down below? In Exodus 32, they've already broken the commandments that God spoke to them from the mountain. And they're worshiping this golden calf. And of course, Aaron himself has been allowing, he hasn't been leading the people, he's been following the people, basically. Gives in to what they request. They're worried that Moses is dead or whatever. And so they're worshiping this golden calf. I think they're thinking it represents Jehovah. But still, they've made a graven image. And so here the Lord is ready to wipe out the people. Read with me in Exodus 32, beginning in verse 7. Then the Lord spoke to Moses, go down at once, for your people, whom you brought up from the land of Egypt, interesting that God would say it that way, have corrupted themselves. They have quickly turned aside from the way which I commanded them. They have made for themselves a molten calf and have worshipped it and have sacrificed to it and said, this is your God, O Israel, who brought you up from the land of Egypt. The Lord said to Moses, I have seen this people, and behold, they are an obstinate people. Now then, let me alone, that my anger may burn against them, and that I may destroy them, and I will make of you a great nation. God is angry here, and rightfully so. But I think God is also testing Moses in this moment. Because Moses probably already had a lot of pretty good reasons to, like, not be so thrilled with the people of God in this moment. They've done nothing but complain pretty much since they came out of Egypt. And they've said, all the Lord has spoken, we will do. All the Lord has spoken, we will do. All the Lord has spoken, we will do. And Moses leaves for like 40 days. Oh, we're going to build the golden calf. Which, by the way, where did they get the gold for that? It was the gold that God gave them from the Egyptians when they left the land of Egypt. They take God's gifts and turn it into an idol. But what does Moses do? Verse 11. Then Moses entreated the Lord his God and said, O Lord, why does your anger burn against your people whom you have brought out from the land of Egypt with great power and with a mighty hand? Why should the Egyptians speak, saying, with evil intent he brought them out to kill them in the mountains and to destroy them from the face of the earth? Turn from your burning anger and change your mind about doing harm to your people. Remember Abraham, Isaac, and Israel, your servants, to whom you swore by yourself and said to them, I will multiply your descendants as the stars of the heavens, and all this land which I have spoken, I will give to your descendants, and they shall inherit it forever. So the Lord changed his mind about the harm which he would do to his people. You think about the amount of meekness and humility that it took for Moses to, when God says, all you have to do is nothing. God said, just leave me alone and I'll go wipe them out and you will be the new leader. It'll be your nation. And Moses appeals to God and says, Lord, this is about you. This is not about me. This isn't about my name or my family or my reputation. Lord, you've made a name for yourself. And what are the Egyptians going to think if you bring them out here and then they just die in the wilderness? And Lord, think about Abraham and Isaac and Jacob. He appeals to God on the basis of God's own promises, which we've been talking about this weekend. All these things just connect together. Is that the kind of thing that we're willing to do? When we've been mistreated, and we've been hurt, and we've been slandered by other people, sometimes even our own brethren, are we willing to intercede for those people? Not only not to take our own vengeance, but to go to God on their behalf, and to do our very best to try to make sure that they're right with God. And that's our first priority. Incredible example that Moses gives. And so Moses turns and comes down the mountain. And of course, when he gets down there and he sees, the Lord has already told him what's going on. But when Moses sees it with his own eyes, what does he do? He just takes the tablets that God had written on and shatters them. Which of course is exactly what the people had already done. They'd broken God's law. And so Moses does that physically in anger. And then eventually he says, just everybody strap on your sword and just go through the camp and kill the people who are doing these things. And it's interesting how many people are killed in this instance. 3,000 people fall by the sword. 3,000? Ring a bell? It's interesting that when the new covenant is inaugurated and Jesus is proclaimed as king in Acts chapter 2, how many souls are added that day? 3,000 souls. So it's interesting that here in the midst of the first covenant being inaugurated, 3,000 die. And then when Jesus' covenant with the people is inaugurated, 3,000 are saved. So trip number six, Moses goes up, and this is after the golden calf incident, and Moses has already gone to bat for the people of Israel, but now he really wants to make sure that they're going to be right with God. And here we have a continued picture of the intercession of Moses, that his goal is to connect the people to God. Exodus 32, beginning in verse 31, it says that Moses returned to the Lord and said, "Alas, this people has committed a great sin. And you, lost my place. And they have made a god of gold for themselves. But now, if you will forgive their sin, and if not, please blot me out from your book which you have written." Moses goes to God again and says, "Please forgive this people. Don't just not destroy them, but forgive them. Restore them to yourself. And if you won't forgive them, take me instead. Take me instead." Incredible that Moses, would have that kind of compassion and desire to see his brethren, his people, made right with God. It reminds us of what Paul said in the book of Romans. "Now, I wish that I could be anathema for the sake of my brethren, the Jews." But that's not the way it works, is it? The Lord says to him in response, verse 33, the Lord said to Moses, "Whoever has sinned against me, I will blot him out of my book. But go now, lead the people where I told you. Behold, my angel shall go before you. Nevertheless, in the day when I punish, I will punish them for their sin." Then the Lord smote the people because of what they did with the calf that Aaron had made. And essentially what God says, and skipping down to verse 3, He says, "Go up to a land flowing with milk and honey, for I will not go up in your midst, because you are an obstinate people, and I might destroy you on the way." And so God kind of at first says, you go ahead and go up to Egypt, but I'm not going with you. And the people hear about this, and they're like, no, we can't do this without God. They go into mourning. None of them put on his ornaments. And so this kind of becomes a thing in Israel, that they don't wear their ornaments all the time after Mount Horeb. And so one more time, Moses goes up, it's going to be two more times, but he goes up a seventh time. And this is, again, after God has said, I'm not going to go up in your midst. I'm not going to be there because you're a stubborn and obstinate people. And read this one with me as well. 33, starting in verse 12. Then Moses said to the Lord, see, you say to me, bring up this people, but you yourself have not let me know whom you will send with me. Moreover, you have said, I have known you by name, and you have also found favor in my sight. Look at verse 13. Now therefore I pray, if I have found favor in your sight, let me know your ways, that I may know you, so that I may find favor in your sight. Consider too that this nation is your people. And he said, my presence shall go with you, and I will give you rest. Then he said to him, if your presence does not go with us, do not lead us up from here. For how then can it be known that I have found favor in your sight, I and your people? Is it not by your going with us, so that I and your people, may be distinguished from all the other people who are upon the face of the earth? The Lord said to Moses, I will also do this thing of which you have spoken, for you have found favor in my sight, and I have known you by name. So essentially, Moses again goes to bat for the people of Israel, and God says, yes, I'll go with you. I'll be with you. And he has one more request. And he says, Lord, show me your glory. In verse 18, that's going to lead us to the last trip up the mountain. In between this, Moses makes the new tablets before he goes up the eighth time. And he goes up, and the Lord causes his name to pass before Moses. In verse 6 of Exodus 34, then the Lord passed by in front of him and proclaimed, the Lord God, compassionate and gracious, slow to anger and abounding in loving kindness and truth, who keeps loving kindness for thousands, who forgives iniquity, transgression, and sin. Yet he will by no means leave the guilty unpunished, visiting the iniquity of the fathers on the children and on the grandchildren to the third and fourth generations. Moses made haste to bow low toward the earth and worship. He said, if now I have found favor in your sight, O Lord, I pray, let the Lord go along in our midst, even though the people are so obstinate, and pardon our iniquity and our sin, and take us as your own possession. So much we could say about God's revelation of himself here. But do you see the goal of Moses? Over and over, Moses' passion is to see God's people connected to him. And isn't that the mission that we have in this world? Is to make ourselves right before the Lord, but to bring people to God, that he might have a people for his own possession in the earth. So Moses comes down from the eighth and final trip, at least at this time, up Mount Sinai, and his face is shining from his encounter with the Lord, when the Lord caused all of his glory to pass before him. And God does answer this prayer. And really the rest of the book of Exodus is then preparing the tabernacle, doing the things that God showed Moses on trip number five. And they build the tabernacle, and what does God do at the end of the book of Exodus? His glory fills the tabernacle. And God comes to dwell with his people, thanks in large part to the work of Moses, who humbly interceded for his people. A couple of applications as we draw the lesson to a close. When we think about the journey that God took Moses on, we need to realize that God may need to break us as well in order for us to serve him and to serve his people. We can't serve God's people when we're prideful. And woe to us when we try to do that, because it's not going to end well. That's what leads to division and strife and so many things. We need to realize it's not about me. It is about God. And then we can help lead his people. Moses made a lot of excuses. God's people need leaders. So what's your excuse? That's kind of the question. Because whatever excuse you have, God has an answer. And we are left without excuse God needs men and women, young and old, to step up and to lead and to serve. More than ever in our generation right now. We need leaders, people who will serve the Lord. And that leadership, by the way, looks at a whole lot of different ways, doesn't it? Moses was a very public, easy to see leadership, but there is leadership that's needed within local churches, both publicly and privately. There is leadership needed, brethren, in our homes from everyone. There is leadership needed in our workplaces and in our schools and in public and from friend to friend, from heart to heart, from house to house. We need people who are leading and trying to help people be reconciled to God. God has given us the ministry of reconciliation. And that's really what I think we see in Moses here. Don't make excuses. Turn to the Lord. He will be sufficient for you. And we don't have time to get into all this morning, but I love the passages where Moses' leadership is challenged. And there's even one point where there's people prophesying that Joshua didn't think needed to be leaders. And he was like, Moses, stop him from prophesying. And Moses is like, hey, like, are you jealous for me? I wish all God's people could be prophets. Moses was not jealous or defensive about his leadership position. He wished that all of God's people would get involved and be involved in the work. Maybe it'd be the same way. And again, we just need to learn to work with one another. In Hebrews 11 that we read right before the lesson, it said that he chose to rather to endure ill treatment with the people of God. But you think about that, where did most of Moses' ill treatment come from? A lot of it came from the people of God, didn't it? And he still stuck with those people and worked for their forgiveness and worked to get them to work together. And that's what we need. Even when we have struggle and we have problems, we're going to hurt each other at times. But like Moses, we've got to learn to work together and not to give up. He intercedes for them. And the thing that needs to drive us to humility and then to leadership is what Moses, what we just read in chapter 33. Let me know your ways that I may know you. Show me your glory. Because it's when we really clearly see God in His mercy and in His justice that we will be better equipped to serve on whatever level that the Lord calls us to serve. In just a moment, we're going to sing a song. And we're going to think about not just Moses, but one who is greater than Moses. Of course, a whole other lesson for another time is the way that Moses points to one who's far greater than Moses himself. And that's the one who came and offered himself. Not just, you know, bought me out, but actually physically died. His own blood was the blood of the covenant. And in every way superior to Moses. The invitation this morning is to submit your life to Jesus Christ. Is if you've been prideful and you've been sinful, it's to have your pride broken. And to come confessing your need for forgiveness. Confessing your sin, confessing that Jesus is indeed going to be Lord of your life. If you're here this morning and you've never obeyed the gospel, you have the opportunity to do that. But if you've started off and you've fallen, or you need encouragement of the brethren here, or maybe you realize that you need to be broken down and built back up, maybe you've been making excuses, and maybe you need to stop doing that and to serve the Lord more with more diligence. If there's any way we can help you to be right with God, please let us know while we stand and while we stand.